and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we are here with episode 441 and part two of my conversation with the director of the Ohio State Marching Band Drumline and the National Director of Sales and Education for the Schools of Music for the Sabian Cymbal Company, Mark Reynolds. We'll get back to him shortly. But first up, Mizzou log rolling, past and present. This past Sunday, as mentioned last week, was the spring semester percussion ensemble concerts. It was set up this time for the studio to perform two separate concerts on the same day, this past Sunday afternoon, and the students performed wonderfully all day. I was thrilled to be among those who got a chance to coach an ensemble, along with previous podcast guests Cliff Walker, Dr. Julia Gaines, and of course, the Director of Percussion Studies, Dr. Megan Arnes, as well as some of our current graduate percussion students getting the chance to coach as well. The students I worked with did Viet Quang's Symbolisms, a piece that I was previously not familiar with, but really grew to like while working with the students. And they did a great job on the piece. I'm really proud of them. This coming Tuesday, April 22nd, the University Band for the School of Music will be performing their second concert of the semester, along with Capital City High School from Jefferson City, Missouri. And I will be making my return to the concert band conducting stage for the first time since prior to the pandemic. I'm very excited to get to do this, and I thank the director of bands, Dr. Brian Sylvie, at the University of Missouri for allowing me the opportunity to conduct this ensemble again, and this time conducting Julie Giroux's Mambo Perro Loco. The students seem to be enjoying working on it, and they've made fantastic progress over the past couple months. If you're in town, come out and watch at 7 p.m. Central. Otherwise, the concert will be streaming on YouTube, and a link will be in the show notes. And with that, let's get back to our conversation with Mark Reynolds. Last week in part one, we got to hear all about Mark's jobs with Sabian, working with Ohio State's Drumline, and some of the great shows that Ohio State Marching Band have done over the past decade or so. This week in part two, we'll hear more about Mark's path to getting where he is now, which included growing up in Columbus, Ohio, his early days of playing percussion and his bowling background, his undergrad years at Ohio State, and some more about his working in the music industry, particularly in the early years of doing that. And as we usually do, we'll close with our typical closing segment. So let's get to it. We recorded this conversation over Zoom in two portions on March 11th and March 17th, 2025. And it begins right now. I want to back up and hear a little bit more about getting you kind of into this point, because you said you grew up in Columbus, correct?
Yes, sir. Yep.
So did you have family members in the arts?
I did not. Yeah. I mean, my great grandfather that I've never met, I was told he was like, at one time he was like this, you know, world-class piano player. And he lived out in California. My grandfather, who's passed now, it was his dad. And he said that, I think he said that he, one of those crazy old stories, like he, when he was 14, just jumped on a boxcar and left home. And, you know, that was the last time he saw his dad. Mm-hmm. So I think when he was older, you know, he tried to like find him like through different, you know, family tree stuff or whatever, and never could really find him, like what he did. But everybody, like, that's the thing in the family. Everybody always says, well, you know, your great grandfather, he was a great piano player. But other than that, like, I have no idea. Like when I was 6 years old or 5 years old, like I was, you know, the old story, playing on pots and pans. And my mom took me to the local music store and said, all right, you drive me crazy. Let's get you some drum lessons. Thank you, Mom. and I started taking drum set lessons when I was 6 years old. The funny story about my percussion career is I was taking private lessons every week from 6 years old all the way until, you know, through college.
Yeah.
But when I got into sixth grade, of course, you know, everybody knows the routine. Like you go and you sign up and then they, you know, hey, try a flute, try a trumpet, you know, whatever. Well, my parents had already been paying for lessons for like 6 years at this point. And right. I was getting pretty good. So I walked in and I said, hey, I want to play drums. And they're like, well, we're already filled up. So let's, and I'm like, what, you know, like you got to be kidding me, but I've been taking lessons. Now being an educator, I know how common that is for parents to go, oh, well, he's been taking lessons. And then you see the kid and he's like double-handed traditional, you know, you're like, wait a minute, you haven't had lessons. So I understand why they were like, yeah, okay, kid, like you've had lessons or whatever. So I just did what I was told. And they told me I was going to play trumpet. They said, you've got the lips to play trumpet. So I was upset and we're in the car on the way back. And my mom was like, well, you got to do what the band director tells you to do. And you can still take drum lessons or whatever. And I was like, okay. Well, I get home and my father worked construction his whole life. And he's an amazing, amazing man. I owe him so much, but he was also a no BS type of guy.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, what the hell have I been paying lessons for? If you're not going to play drums, like, no, we're going to figure this out. So he called the band director and said, no, he's been taking lessons. And, you know, the band director, who I still know to this day, he's long retired, but we still talk about this. He said that he just appeased my dad and was like, fine, come in. I want to hear him play.
Yeah.
So he tried to bamboozle me. And he admits this now. I walked into his office, the little sixth grader, and he opened up the Haskell Har book. If you remember that, you know, snare drum book, the back page was a class A snare drum solo called Bunker Hill. And there was Downfall Paris and like Bunker Hill. It was like the last two solos. And he's like, well, if you've been taking lessons for the last 6 years, let me open up to this page and, you know, play this for me. And I was so excited because I'd already been through both of the Haskell Har books and I'd already knew that solo. So like I played it down.
Yeah.
And he just looked at me and he said, let me look at your schedule. I think we're just going to put you in the symphonic band, in the eighth grade band. I'll work it out in your schedule. So I didn't even do sixth grade band. Like I was so lucky that but to this day, he tells me, he's like, yeah, I'm not going to lie. I tried to bamboozle you because I was afraid you were going to fall on your face.
And then
I'd say, see, you can't play this. Like you got to play trumpet.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how that whole thing started. And then through high school and college.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I've definitely talked to people on the show over the years who have had a parent do something similar, like, you know, like stop the band director, like stand in front of the band director's car and just be like, no, this is what's happening. So like,
it's
like that kind of thing where it's like the parents like, no.
It's a hard conversation to have. It's a hard conversation to have with parents.
Yeah.
Because I've been on that side of it where I'm like, little Susie, like, I know she really wants to play percussion and I know her parents want to play percussion, but like, just not where it needs to be, you know? And I'm trying to remember, I think it was, have you ever had John Mapes or Ian Grom on your podcast? Okay. Great educators. And for anybody listening, they probably know the names, but they have been teaching at Chino Hills forever. And Chino Hills has been like this amazing program. I remember I had an opportunity to talk to them one time, and I think it might've even been in a bar at WGI. And I was young, you know, at that time, you know, coming up teaching and everything. And they were young, but like way more successful than I was at their programs. And I remember, you know, people were asking them like, how do you pick your shows? And like, how do you teach these kids how to play flam drags and flam fives and all this other stuff? I wanted to know how they picked their percussionists. Because every kid, I remember going to WGI with my oldest son, who was a percussionist, and he was in high school. And I remember him looking at me and going, Dad, these kids look like they're in college. Like they're all like 6'1" and like, you know, buff and where, how do they get these kids? So I remember asking John or Ian, one of them, like, how do you pick your kids for sixth grade? Like, do you give them an aptitude test? Do you do like a timing test or anything with them? And I don't know whether they were joking or not. Maybe, you know, all these years later, maybe they were joking, but they didn't seem like they were joking. But what they said was, we don't even give them a test. Like in California, football's not a big deal like it is in the Midwest. Like where you're at in Ohio, like football's a big deal. Like kids want to play football or they want to play sports. Our kids, they're not interested in football. And they even told me, like, if you come to like a football game, there's really not a whole lot of people there. It's just basically band parents and football parents or whatever. So I said, okay, well, you don't give them a test. What do you do? And he said, we literally look at the kid and they sit down. And if they're a sport kid or they look like they're a sport kid, we talk to them about sports. Like, oh, you play soccer? Yeah, I play soccer. Or, oh, I play baseball, whatever. He goes, those are the kids we want. And he said, and the final thing is if they can sit there for 5 minutes and have a conversation with me and look in my eyes and be able to like go back and forth without looking down or being shy or whatever, he goes, we tell them, we want you to be an athlete on the drum line here. And he goes, and they get excited about it. And he goes, so like, we'll teach them how to play drums. Yeah. What you can't teach them is like how to be excited and how to be athletic and, you know, that type of thing. So I always thought that was really interesting. Yeah. You know, and there were a lot of conversations I remember having with parents that were mad when I was teaching full time that, you know, but my kid really wants to play drums. And, you know, I get that, but like, you can't have 77 drummers, you know, percussionists and like three trumpet players in your band, you know, it's one of those old adages, like trying to figure out like how to please not everybody all the time, but how to please some of the people, you know, it's a tough conversation to have with parents.
You know, when you were growing up, were you involved in anything? You mentioned sports. I mean, were you doing sports? Were you doing student government? Were you in mathletes? You know, like what else was part of your life at that point?
Honestly, growing up in middle school and high school, I was kind of a nerd. Okay. I played football 1 year and I was a kind of a bigger kid. So they said, hey, you can play on the offensive line. Did not enjoy the football thing. So I played baseball for a while until I was like maybe in seventh grade or whatever. But the two things that I love doing outside of music, and I'm kind of gonna, you know, give my students some food here.
Yeah, sure.
But I loved roller skating.
Okay.
And bowling. Like I was a big roller skating and bowling nerd. I roller skated all the time. I did the speed team. I then became a floor guard. And then I became like the DJ. Like when I was like a junior in high school, they're like, Mark, you're a music guy. Like, why don't you DJ for us? So like, I love that gig. Like every Saturday and Sunday, I was like playing, you know, all the, you know, Sugar Hill Gang and all the stuff that you would skate to in the 80s and, you know, stuff like that. And then I also bowled all the time. I was on two or three leagues a week, through high school. And I had like a 235 average.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to bowl all the time. And then obviously college happened and I had to stop bowling and, you know, stuff like that. But funny enough, last Sunday, I don't know why, Pete, but like maybe, you know, some people go through a midlife crisis and they buy a Corvette. Like, I feel like I'm going through a midlife crisis and I want to bowl again.
Oh,
so last Sunday, my wife was busy and she was like, oh, I'm going out with the girls to get lunch. And I'm like, I think I'm going to go bowling. So I went to the local bowling alley. This is just last Sunday. I threw a couple games, back was hurting, my knees were hurting. Well, this guy was watching me or whatever. And he's like, hey, you know, you have like an old school style. Did you used to bowl? And I'm like, yeah, 35 years ago. Well, long story short, I walked out of there 2 hours later with a brand new ball, brand new bag, gloves. Like, so now I'm like trying to get back into it. So I bowled twice last week.
Awesome.
And I did something to my knee. So now I'm wearing a knee brace and I'm like, oh, great. You know?
Yeah.
So yeah. So bowling and, you know, roller skating and drums were kind of my life in middle school and high school. So I was a big nerd.
that's awesome. Well, that's where I thought this was going, was like, there's going to be a new ball. It's in here somewhere.
Oh, within one hour of being there, you know, the guy, you know what? I should hire that guy at Sabian.
Yeah, there it is.
Because he was the guy that worked in the pro shop. So he's one who drilled my ball and everything. And he was like, nice. Well, hey, if you're ever interested. And he's like, man, you throw a good ball, like, you know, blah, blah, blah. You just got to get the rust off. And you know, 2 hours later, I'm walking out, like, you know, paying for a ball, bag, shoes, the whole deal.
Okay. So
he was a good sales guy.
Nice. Well, a couple questions. One, do you have any 300 games?
I don't. I've had a couple 279s. That's the best I've done. Nice. You know, and I think I had a series wise, if you know bowling, I think I had a couple 650, you know, series games out of three games, you know, or whatever. But yeah, never a 300. I've gotten close, like not in league, but I've gotten close, like practicing.
Sure.
I think, you know, but you can't count that. Like bowlers get mad at you if you say, well, I had a 299.
Right.
Well, there's no proof. So.
Right. Sure. Yeah. And then the other thing is, do you have like a specific spot that you throw, like in terms of like the spin? Are you like a, do you have like a deep spin on the ball that's going to like have to hook like way out? And then there's like the super shove left kind of thing.
It's so funny. Now we're on bowling talk.
Yeah. This let's do
great.
It. Yeah.
This is great. Well, back in the day, mm-hmm. I had a lot more strength. Sure. And you know, I really could, you know, get the rotation down on the ball mm-hmm. to kind of get into the pocket. So I would like stand, like if you're familiar with bowling, there's like four or five dots, right?
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. I would stand like all the way over to like the second dot on the left and throw all the way across to the in between the gutter and the first arrow, and it can come back and nice. Hit it. 35 years later now, I was like, I got the new ball drilled and it fit me. I wasn't using like an alley ball or whatever. And I was like, oh man, this is going to be great. Yeah. And I think the first two balls were gutters.
Of course.
I can't put the velocity and the spin on the ball like I used to. So now I just try, Pete, not to fall over.
Oh, sure.
And not to embarrass myself, you know, and make sure that I go slow enough that I don't bust out the, you know, my knees with all the arthritis.
Of course. Or the ball doesn't do like the shoot back as you're doing the.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Yeah. I've done that a couple of times with like alley balls or, you know, whatever, but you know, I'm pretty excited because, you know, usually every couple of years we'll go on a bowl trip and we'll take the, like at the Ohio State marching band, and we'll take the kids to go bowling. Mm-hmm. And I'm always excited and I'm like, oh man, I'm going to show them. And then I throw the first couple balls and I'm like, okay, I'm not doing this. So I'm really excited to go on a bowling trip with the drumline soon. So I could show them that I'm not too old.
Yeah. And then you'll walk in and they'll be like, do you have your own ball? No.
Exactly. Then I'll be called a nerd because I've got a couple balls in a bag in my own shoes. And what about you? Like, did you do anything like that growing up? Like, was it just music or
no?
Or?
No, I did a lot of sports. And I have a lot.
Okay.
I have a lot of older siblings, and that was like we all did sports, and we all did music. So it was like we were like, and I was in a smaller high school that everyone did. That's the thing. Like, it wasn't a special thing. Like, everyone in the high school kind of did band, or they did choir, or they were also in sports, or so it's like everyone was just really involved. So
was that in Missouri? Did you grow up in Missouri? Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
But yeah. It was just,
So you have to find your other interest, you know, for sure, you know, and for some reason I just kind of gravitated to roller skating and bowling.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not awesome. Cool. Like you, like playing baseball and football.
That's fine. So were you at Ohio State, you were a music major?
Yep. Yeah. Music ed. Well, actually I was first, the first thing was I thought I wanted to be a jazz studies major.
Okay.
Cause I was really into drum set. And actually when I graduated high school, I really didn't want to do marching stuff anymore. Mm-hmm. I was really gravitating to drum set. So that's what I was going to do.
Yeah.
And that's what I started doing, like performance, jazz, you know, jazz studies or whatever. And then, again, enter Jim Swearingen into my life. You know, mm-hmm. he got me this teaching job right out of high school. And then after like maybe the first year, I saw him somewhere and oh, hi, Mr. Swearingen. And he's like, oh, how are you doing? How's things at Ohio State? And I said, oh, it's great. And he goes, now, you know, what is your major? And I said, you know, I'm doing, you know, jazz studies, performance, you know, drum set. And he just kind of looked at me and like a little disappointed. And he put his arm around me and he said, Mr. Reynolds, let me explain something to you. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, you don't need a piece of paper to say that you can play. If you're a great drum set player, you'll get gigs if that's what you want to do. But you do need a piece of paper to teach and support your family and get a regular paycheck. And it didn't hit me at that time until like maybe a couple months later. And I remember saying something to my mom and dad. And once again, my mom and dad were like, well, Jim's always right. So like, maybe you should think about going into education. So I did, you know, so my second year I switched to education and that's what I did. Cause you know, like everybody, it's like, I want to be a high school band director with a percussion focus. And I want to teach all the great, I, you know, want a marching band that's going to win BOA Grand Nationals and play all this amazing stuff, which it doesn't always work out that way. But yeah, I was a music ed major.
Were you studying like primarily jazz or were you doing like the whole classical percussion and doing ensembles and all that stuff as part of your time?
Yeah, I was doing the whole thing. You know, as everybody knows, your first year, you're just kind of smattering of classes, you know, trying to get your, you know, elected classes done and or your prereqs done and get all the math classes and psych classes and stuff done. So I really wasn't doing a ton. So after that first year, I mean, I was taking drum set lessons, but also I think at that time at Ohio State, you also had to take applied lessons on, you know, concert percussion. Yeah. So I was already kind of realizing that like, man, I really like this marimba thing. You know, I really like timpani, you know, stuff like that. So after that second quarter, at that time, Ohio State was on quarters. So you went three, you know, quarters for a year. So it was after that second quarter that I switched to music ed and realized I love playing marimba, which is kind of like what got me going on the marching side of things. Like when I was at Rhythm X, I wrote the front ensemble music, but I also taught the front ensemble. So like, that was kind of my thing. Like I really got into the front ensemble, teaching the front ensemble and stuff like that. So it wasn't until I got to Ohio State that I was back to the battery percussion side of things, you know? So I would say most of my writing and teaching career, I did a lot of front ensemble work because I love playing marimba, you know, just fell in love with the instrument. So that was an easy thing for me, like transferring to education. Then I kind of like jumped in and was like, oh, now I can really get serious about playing marimba and timpani and, you know, cymbal excerpts and learning Porgy and Bess and yeah, as we've all done.
Sure. Well, who were you, who was the teaching percussion at that point at Ohio State?
You know, I was there in a really strange time. So Dr. James Moore was the percussion professor my first year, and Dr. Moore was amazing. And I only had him for 1 year because then he retired, but he was actually the first percussion professor at Ohio State. I think it like he started like in the '60s or something like that. Like they never had like a music program. Sure. And some people don't know, Jim was also a science, crazy science buff. Like he was a chemistry major because when he went to Ohio State, you couldn't be a music major.
Right.
Yeah. So he got, I think, a chemistry degree, but he actually, and I think I got the story right, because I talked to him about this my first year and he talked about it a lot. He would get in his old filing cabinet and pull out his dissertation that he did when he was doing his doctorate at Ohio State. And he did his dissertation on Keylon bars, like synthetic marimba bars. Yeah. So he actually helped with the chemical formula of what the Musser Keylon marimba, as we know it now, is.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's why if some people remember, when you would order a Musser synthetic Keylon marimba, it would come with a pair of scarlet and gray James L. Moore, like marimba mallets.
Yeah.
Because that was part of the deal. I think maybe, you know, maybe he got a commission or something like that on every one, but they all came with a pair of scarlet and gray James L. Moore mallets because he was behind helping them with the chemical formula of that. So after that first year, he retired and then they went on a search, couldn't find anybody. So they brought in the principal percussionist for the Columbus Symphony, a guy named Jack Jenny, came in and he ran the studio for the second year. And then they went on a search again and I remember at that time, it was my third year, and me and a guy named Mark Berry, is the percussion professor at Western Kentucky. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So him and I was at Ohio State at the same time. We kind of went through the program together, and him and I were like the ones that were, you know, turning off the lights in the practice room at midnight when the custodian would walk through to make sure everybody was out. We'd stuff a pillow in between the resonators so that we could get some sleep and then, you know, the routine. Mark was amazing. It still is an amazing player, great friend. But when we went through that session, that third year, and we're going through the program, we were, you know, two pretty good players, and they came to us and said, "Hey, we would like for you to take a lesson with the three finalists that we have." And we're like, "Yeah, absolutely." So I took a lesson. The three finalists, I think I'm remembering right, it was a guy named Larry Kapton. I don't know if you know that name. He was a finalist. A guy named Fernando Meza was a finalist. Yep. And Tim Adams.
Oh, wow. That's a solid three. That's a really strong finalist final group.
It was pretty good. And I was like, "Oh man, this is great." You know, like, so in, you know, and younger in my career in college, like, we didn't really know who a lot of these people were, but I knew Tim Adams, you know, from Timpani and everything. So we took I took a lesson with each and really enjoyed all three lessons, but I really loved Tim Adams. You know, I was like, "Man, this is going to be the guy." And I think Mark felt the same way and everybody felt the same way. And now Tim and I just reconnected like maybe 3 or 4 years ago. Well, no, it was about 5 years ago because it was over COVID. He called me up and said, "Hey, I'm trying to find stuff for my percussion students. Would you mind doing a thing on how you got to the industry, blah, blah, blah." So we start talking and I said, "Do you remember me?" And he goes, "Were you at Ohio State?" And I said, "I was." And so we talked about the lesson and he goes, "Yeah, man." He goes, "I thought for sure I was going to get that gig." And then he told me the story. They offered it to him, but it was right when he won the Indianapolis Symphony gig. So he said, "I'll do it. But I can only teach Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and a little bit of Thursday. And then I got to drive to Indianapolis and do the gig." And Ohio State was like, "Uh-uh, like, you got to commit to this full time or, you know, we're going to move on." So he didn't want to give that gig up. So he didn't get the job. Fernando Meza got the job, ended up being the best thing for me in my life and my career. Like, Fernando was amazing. And he came in like where we were all kind of a little complacent. And I was getting ready to do my recital. And I remember him, my first lesson, he's like, "All right, I'm seeing here on the paper that you're a junior. You're going to do your recital. You're a music ed major." I said, "Yes, sir." And he's like, "All right, what are you playing?" And I said, "Well, this is kind of what I had picked out." And he's like, "That's only 30 minutes of music." I'm like, "Yeah, that's all we have to do, you know?" And he's like, no, you're a better player than that. You're going to do an hour. You're going to do what I expect." And I was like, "Oh, are you kidding me?" Like, he came in and kicked our butts.
Yeah.
And it was the best thing for the studio. It was amazing time. A lot of energy. Everything was just awesome. And just really kicked our butts. And he kind of took the corner and turned it, and it was great. And I think he was only there 2 years. And then he left with Professor Kirchhoff, who was the DOB, and they both went to the University of Minnesota, which he is still at the University of Minnesota all these years later. And then when I was finishing everything up, I was already done with the recital and all that stuff. I was finishing things up, and then Dr. Bump came in.
I was like, I figured he was going to,
he surfaced
that before Truman. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was at Ohio State and I'd known him from, you know, his amazing timpani playing and stuff like that. And even though I was done with that, I signed up and took some graduate lessons with him that first year. And really great, like, tons of knowledge on the timpani side, and really glad I had that time with him. And then I was out of there. And then I think he was only there a couple years and then went to Truman or Memphis or Truman. Somewhere.
Oh, did he go Memphis before Truman? He might've.
I think I don't know why I was thinking Memphis for some reason, but anyway, he left after a couple of years. And then Dr. Powell came in and she has completely revolutionized that studio. Like, the studio is amazing and she's done a great job with it. So I tell people I had five teachers in I think 4 years, you know, was a thing. But I wouldn't trade it for the world. Like, I tell people, like, it would have been great to study with one person, but Mark and I talked about it like years and years ago. Like, it was great that, like, we had all these different viewpoints, and we got a little bit of something from everybody, which was awesome. Which is always great, you know, always learn, always try to find something that you can learn from somebody else for sure.
It can be an interesting thing though. I think it's because I think some people would be really, that would be a really tough thing. Because they just may not, you know, sometimes you just want the person who's going to like really bring you forward. And it sounds like you might've been self-motivated enough that you could like really learn from all of these different people and it would be fine.
Yes. Yeah. And I think a lot of people were that way. I think at that time, like we were hungry to like move forward. And like I said, at that time, there were some great players there, you know, and Mark was definitely one of the better ones for sure. And because we were friends, there was also a little competitiveness. Like I didn't want to get left in the dust because he could play. I mean, he was awesome. I really looked up to him. So he kind of helped a lot of us kind of get motivated. And, you know, and back then, you know, in the early 90s, Ohio State was kind of like a band director factory for percussionists. You know, like all my friends that I went to school with, we all became educators at middle schools and high schools and stuff like that. It's a little, I mean, there's still a lot of percussion educators that come out of Ohio State. I don't get over to that side of campus too often. But, you know, Susan is just doing an amazing job in getting her students ready to go on to get their master's or get their PhD. And, you know, the program there has been awesome. So she's kind of taken it and, like I said, revolutionized it a little bit. And, you know, it's pretty awesome.
When you end up going into on the industry side, what are the things that either connect or make the various positions you've had in the industry similar, different, you know, what kinds of things like are connective tissue for the various jobs you've had?
You know, this might sound a little basic, but you know, I've been thinking about this a lot because I'm working on the presentation for Troy University next month. A lot of it boils down to relationships, not burning bridges, and being humble.
Sure.
You know, I mean, there's so many people out there that know way more than all of us, you know, combined. Sure. And knowing that, like, you don't know it all, like, I feel like I've been so lucky to have the experiences I've had in the music industry, from retail to Promark to Dynasty to retail again to now Sabian. I've been so grateful to have those opportunities, but like every once in a while, like I'll start to get like, yeah, I know what I'm doing, you know? And then all of a sudden it's like, man, slap you right in the face and like go, yeah, you don't understand how to market this, or you don't understand how to do that or do this. I think those are the three big things to me, you know, and being humble is one of those big things that like just being willing to do it. You know, I've had conversations with younger kids that are quite honestly struggling. Like they're finishing up their college career. They're either going to be a performance major or a music ed major.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they decide, I don't know that I want to do this for the rest of my life. You know, life changes, you know, maybe you meet your life partner or, you know, you want to move or you don't like living in the area that you're in.
Or you're burned out from doing.
Yes. Or you're burned out. Exactly. And it's a real struggle. And I really enjoy talking to students like that, that are like, Mark, I don't know what I want to do. Like, I thought this is what I want to do. I thought I want to be a music educator, but I just finished student teaching. I don't know that I want to do this. You know, like, how do you get into the music industry? That type of thing. And I tell people all the time, like, you have to be willing to try new things. And I wasn't always the best at it. You know, like I stated earlier, when I started at Columbus Percussion, I was like, I'm not a sales guy. Like, I don't know how to sell. Like, I haven't had a business class. I don't know what I'm doing. If I wouldn't have had an open mind to like listen and to just understand that like, it's not selling anything. It's just all about relationships. And it's about helping people, you know, and being honest with people. I have some great relationships with kids that are getting ready to graduate from Florida State. And, you know, Tim Heath at Wake Forest, you know, Brian West at TCU, you know, all these great educators that I connect with some of their students, you know, because they ask me like, hey, how do you do this? How do you do that? unfortunately, there are some kids that are like, you know, they ask me, what is the best way to get into the music industry? Mm-hmm. And 100%, there's no easy way. The best way to do it is to go to music retail. Mm-hmm. And some kids don't want to hear that. They're like, oh, I'm not working at a music store. Like, I'm not going to stock shelves. I'm not going to, like, you know, do this, do that. I mean, that's a really humbling thing for, you know, a student that is like set in first or second chair in the wind ensemble. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're teaching this great high school drumline program or whatever. And now all of a sudden they have to work 8 to 5 and they get an hour for lunch. And, you know, that is the best education that they'll ever have. And I tell you, when I left Dynasty, in 2013 and went to Reading Music to move back to Columbus, that was probably the biggest case in humility I ever had. Cause at that point in time, when I was at Dynasty, I was the vice president of sales and marketing for the company. We were going strong. I mean, we had Blue Devils and Glassman when they were around, and Phantom Regiment, Paul Rennick and Phantom Regiment just came on board, and, you know, all these, you know, high level groups. And I think at that time, Dynasty had 7 of the top 12 in independent world, you know, WGI finals. We had Mark Ford and Eric Willey and mm-hmm. Scott Herring and all these great people. And I was excited to be a part of that. But then I was like, you know, I got to make this change for my family and I got to get back home. And when I took that job with Reading Music, I was a road guy. And if anybody out there listening knows what a road guy is for a music store, it is a tough job. And I will say it is the hardest job I've ever had, because talk about a certain bit of humility to go from being the vice president of sales and marketing for a company like Dynasty, mm-hmm. where you're in the suite at DCI championships and you're hobnobbing with all these people. And literally, like, a month later, I've got like 2 flutes under my arm. I got a bass clarinet in one hand. I got a Barry Sax in the other, and I'm walking through a middle school during class changes. And I'm just trying to find the band room just so I could drop off the repairs and say, yeah, thank you. You know, like, there were many days where I got in that van and I called my wife and I'm like, what the hell am I doing? Like, this is hard. Like, this is tough work, you know? And 2 months ago I was at DCI World Finals, you know, like, what am I doing? And the string director is telling me she needs strings for her violin. And I, you know, what the heck am I doing? So I always go back to that and explain to students that, like, you have to be able to be vulnerable, and you have to be willing to have some humility and be vulnerable in the midst of, yeah, I'm going to have to stock shelves and I'm going to have to, like, wet a reed for a kid, you know, on a saxophone so that he can get a good sound or she can get a good sound out of it. That's not what I imagine myself doing after 20 years in the industry. Like, what was I thinking? But, you know, I mean, those things come with, you know, with all that great work and that great humility. Mm-hmm. If you grind, like, those things will come up. And I've had conversations with students that say, like, oh, I need to get a job at a music store. I'm not doing that. Like, why would I want to do that? Like, no, I want to work for Pearl. Or I want to work for Yamaha. It's like, dude, it starts in the music industry side, mm-hmm. from the retail portion. And the reason why I say that is because I didn't know the first thing about selling products. Yeah. I didn't know the first thing. Like, honestly, Pete, like, maybe this will make me sound dumb, but when I got to Columbus Percussion, they're like, yeah, just take 20% off. And I'm like, how do I figure out 20%? Like, I can't remember back in my high school days or whatever. Like, wait, how do I figure out 20%? Is it the cost times 0.2 or is it 1 point? Like, the whole thing was, like, foreign to me. Mm-hmm. But after learning, like, all that business acumen of, like figuring out, like, how to talk to people and how not to sell to them and how to get them to trust you and give them good advice and how to figure out 20% off and, you know, how to set up a spreadsheet. You know, like, back when I started in 2000, I mean, there were only a couple drum companies that were even online.
Right.
Like, everybody was calling you and going, hey, I got a quote from Steve Weiss. Like, can you beat this? You know, like, working through those things and stocking shelves and understanding, like, studying on why this drum pedal is the best bass drum pedal out there. You know, the DW 5000 at that time was a big thing. And, you know, understanding how to study that stuff and doing the homework, like that's stuff that some people don't want to do. And I'm not begrudging them for it. Like, you know, they have bigger dreams and why would I do that when I want to work for Yamaha and be the artist relations director talking to the drummer from 21 Pilots?
Yeah.
I don't, maybe that's what they're going to do. And maybe they're out there doing it right now. I don't know. But for the people that want to get into the music industry, going to music retail, going to your local music store and saying, look, I'm a music ed major and maybe I've graduated, maybe I haven't. If you guys are hiring, let me know because I have a passion for the industry and I want to help my local community. Like music stores need that, you know? And I tell you another thing, Pete, that a lot of people, this has nothing really to do with percussion, but sure. I'll tell you the big need in music industry right now and something that you can do. And you don't even need to like go to college and be a music major to do it, you know, but like the instrument repair world needs so many people. Every music store that I talk to, every retail store that I talk to every week says, hey, if you know any, you know, instrument repair people, we could use them. Yeah. Everybody is struggling trying to find that. And like, if you like tinkering with stuff, and you have a little bit of background, whether it's in percussion or, you know, clarinet or trumpet or whatever, and you like tinkering with stuff, find a music store that will, you know, believe in you and send you to like get some training and stuff like that. And, you know, you can make a nice little living being an instrument repair person. And you probably know as well as I do, we have a hard time at Ohio State, you know, okay, we have four trumpets, you know, jammed up. Like, how do we get the valves unstuck? You know, like that type of thing. I think that is something that NAMM is starting to really push.
Yeah.
You know, trying to get people out there that are interested in music, in the music industry, repairing instruments, you know? So go to your local music store, help them out, you know, do those things, ask those questions. And that is a great foot in the door. That's how I got started because I was just helping people at Columbus Percussion and helping band directors. And guess what happens when you work for a music store? You also answer the phone and you talk to the Yamaha people and you talk to the Pearl people. And that's how I got to ProMark. Mm-hmm. Like they were calling me going, hey, we have an artist that's in your area. Like, can you sell them the, oh yeah. Like, hey, how's your day going? Mm-hmm. One thing leads to, oh, what do you do? Oh, I'm teaching this local high school group that just won WGI World Championships. Oh, well, have you ever thought about the industry? Like, no, I haven't. Like, hey, how about you fly to Houston and take a look at ProMark? And I was an idiot when it came to, I had no idea what that meant. And then I went and I, you know, was like, hey, would you want to be the product manager? And luckily I have an amazing wife that was like, yeah, let's pack up away from our whole family and move our 5-year-old and 2-year-old all the way to Houston, Texas. But that's how that started because I was at Columbus Percussion. And I started having relationships with these people that are doing what I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
You know, I talk to people all the time, you know, when I go to stores and they're like, hey, you know, like, and I'm like, you're doing the right thing. You know, you're working at Dallas Percussion right now and you're, you know, schlepping snare drums and, you know, you're learning the business and you're learning how to talk to people. And, you know, I think once people realize that the music industry goes beyond just being a rep for, you know, Sabian or Zildjian or Yamaha or whoever, those people, if you talk to any one of those people, very few of those people, Pete, have gone to business school, got an MBA, and now they're, you know, well, now I'm going to apply because I love music and I'm going to do this. Like very few of those people are out there. Most people that are in the position I'm in started teaching. Yep. They started at a music retail store, Chris Hankus. I don't know if you know Chris at Mapex. KHS, he was like, you know, worked for, I think it was Schmidt Music up in Minnesota. He worked up there for years and years and years. And now he's like, you know, a bigwig at KHS, you know, doing absolutely amazing things. And almost everybody that I could use that example, everybody started, you know, doing something in music retail because you learn a lot, whether you like it or not.
All right. So, Mark, I finish out with a segment called Random Ask Questions.
Cool.
All right. First question is an issue in percussion performance or percussion education that most gets under your skin or drives you the most nuts.
Oh, damn. That's a good question. I would say probably the biggest thing that drives me nuts is from a percussion standpoint, and I'm speaking from the university side, the lack of knowledge that we send educators that aren't percussionists, the lack of knowledge that we send them out into the world to teach percussion. So what I mean is, like, you know, I think everybody does their best to have a great method program, you know, where they're taking, you know, music educators that are getting ready to go out and teach, that are flute players or trumpet players, trombone players. I feel like there's so many things for them to learn.
Yeah.
And you know, when I was a student and I was taking brass methods, like, yeah, I had to figure out how to blow into a trumpet, but that kind of got to the same range as, like, oh yeah, I can change my embouchure a little bit and get a sound on a trombone or tuba, right, or something, mm-hmm, like that. Same thing with flutes, you know, mm-hmm, clarinets, you know, stuff like that. Like, you can do that. But with percussion, I feel like we're just woefully ill prepared to, like, go out and teach middle school percussion or high school percussion, if you're not used to it. So, like, I would love to see, like, some sort of initiative in university programs where they do 2 semesters. Maybe even, like, your entry level into, you know, when you get into school, college of music or something like that, you have to take percussion methods. And then before you go out and student teach, you should have to take maybe percussion methods one more time to cover all the stuff that you didn't cover. Cause I don't know how you guys kind of do yours, but they try to cover a lot of stuff, but it is literally just blanketing over,
yeah,
you know, like, this is a timpani, you know, like, how do you tune the heads? Like, you know, do you get into that? Like, what are the different variations of triangles and sizes and timbres and tambourines and stuff like that? So I would say that's kind of my biggest pet peeve of seeing people, nobody's fault, but, like, they're just not prepared when they go out and teach, you know, in terms of percussion, if they're not a percussionist.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I know on our end, we've had like a 2 semester sequence that was an option, but the problem is we were trying to get enough students to take it so it could make that kind of
thing. Oh, right.
And as you know, it's impossible to get everything in 1 semester. You just can't do it. You can only, like you said, blanket over it, or just like mention it and be like, all right, that's marching percussion, you know?
And, right. Good luck.
Or this drum set. Yeah, there it is. Like, we've thought about it a lot, just trying to figure out what are ways that we can kind of get to some of the other aspects of percussion. Actually, one of the things we've done, which I think would be good for most schools, is we now offer a non-major percussion ensemble that could cover some of this material in a, you know, an ensemble format.
Yeah. 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 I know at Ohio State, we have a class that kids can sign up for. I think there's an average of 15 to 20 each, you know, in the spring semester. It's only offered in the spring semester. And basically we call it marching band techniques.
Yeah.
And basically it's for anybody that wants to sign up, that's getting ready to go out and student teach. They've already had percussion methods. And then I come in once or twice for some class periods and talk about orchestration, talk about, you know, a little more in depth about this is how you tune a snare drum, you know, make sure the batter head is lower than the bottom head and, you know, don't let kids mess around with the vertical adjustment knobs and, you know, stuff like that. And then we also talk about the pros and cons of, like, how to pick 6th graders to play percussion, you know, like timing tests and, you know, stuff like that. So we kind of do that, but it's only like maybe 1 or 2 sessions. So it's only like an additional 4 hours or something like that.
Yeah.
But that's kind of like how we work around it. And like you said, like, not everybody takes it. It's an elective class if they want to take it or whatever. But yeah, I mean, that's a great way to do it for sure.
All right. We'll get to some other questions, not percussion related, but has anyone ever nailed an impression of you? And if so, how'd they do it?
Actually, yeah. Last year we have I'm sure you guys have the same thing, like the Halloween rehearsal band rehearsal. Last year, I don't know. I was going through a midlife crisis and I decided I was going to buy a motorized scooter to get around campus.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know how it is, like, when you're teaching marching band in the summer, you've got tenors over here and they're in subsectionals and bass drums over here. And I was like, man, I've only got 2 hours of sectionals and I want to make sure I spend time. So I went out and I got this Scooter off of TikTok. Mm. And so, like, you know, of course the kids, you know, old guy on a scooter, you know, making fun of me. And I'm like, hey, you know, but at least I'm getting from point A to point B and, you know, whatever. Yeah. Well, then more and more people started, like, some of the students bought some scooters and they're like, wait, where'd you get that? You know, whatever. So for the Halloween weekend or the Halloween rehearsal or whatever, the entire assemble section dressed up because I have a lot of Sabian gear, right? Like, sure. So like I'm always wearing like a Sabian shirt, you know, or whatever. So all the kids went out and got Sabian shirts, the same ones, and they put glasses on and a beard and they all borrowed scooters and they came into the band hall with scooters. And it was a pretty darn good impression.
Nice.
So I'll go with that one.
That's great. That's really funny. Nice. All right. What was your worst job growing up?
Oh, this is easy. So, I mean, like all of us, we've all had jobs, whether it was working in a shoe store, fast food restaurant, you know, whatever. And there was a time right before I was getting ready to graduate high school. I was trying to get money for college and, you know, the whole routine. And I was working at White Castle, the hamburger place.
Yeah.
And I got a better offer to leave that job and go to Cracker Barrel. So there was a Cracker Barrel in my hometown.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this will be awesome, right? So I go over there, I apply, you know, a couple of days later, they call me, hey, we would like you to start, like, perfect. I let White Castle know. 2 weeks later, I come in, it was like on a Friday night, right? And I think my hours I was supposed to work was like 5 to 10 or something that night.
Sure.
I went in at 5 o'clock. And they said, oh, you're the new guy. And I said, yep. And they said, okay, come with me. And it was a little hectic and a lot of things going around. They take me in the back of the kitchen. And this guy is like cooking. And he's like, all right, here's all the orders. And like these waitresses and waiters were coming in and putting orders up on the thing. And I'm looking at it and I am completely lost.
Oh my.
And the guy's like yelling at me. And he's like, let's go. That's supposed to be chicken fried steak or whatever it was. And I'm like trying to grab stuff. And I don't know, the first thing about it, the waitresses are yelling at me. They're like, what the heck is going on? And they're yelling and screaming at me. I did the best I could for 2 hours. And the guy was trying to help me. And he looked over and he goes, haven't you done this before? And I'm like, no, this is my first day. And he's like, oh crap. I thought you were somebody from another store. They thought they were getting a cook from another place to come in and cover. And they didn't know that I've never cooked. I knew nothing about it. So the guy goes, I am so sorry. He goes, but we're going to need you. So just why don't you go out back, take a 20-minute break and come back in and we'll figure it out. I went out back, took a 15-minute break, took my apron off and everything, went back in, gave it to the boss and said, I'm out of here. And that was the worst job I had. So I lasted as a cook at Cracker Barrel for about 2.5 hours. And then I was gone.
Wow. Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. That was a little nuts, but yeah. You know, it was the only job I ever quit. Like, yeah. You know, on that day. So whatever.
Wow. That is wild. Okay. This is going to be related then. What is your biggest kitchen mess up? Not Cracker Barrel related.
All right, let's don't talk Cracker Barrel.
Yeah.
Back when I was probably in college, my mom always made this chocolate cake with this caramel icing.
Ooh,
and it was nice. One of those things that like every birthday, every Christmas, Thanksgiving, mom, are you making your, you know, chocolate cake? Well, I think it was in maybe high school or, you know, something like that. And my sister and I decided we were going to make this cake for my mom for her birthday. Like she'll love it. Like, let's make the cake. We didn't know the first thing about cooking. And so I'm like, oh, I can do this. And I got the recipe from my aunt. Well, I know now that there is a difference between Crisco oil and Crisco shortening.
Yeah.
And you could probably tell where that's going. So I'm reading the instructions and it was like something, whatever of Crisco is what my aunt put. So instead of putting Crisco oil into the batter, I put Crisco shortening into the batter. And my sister and I didn't know any difference.
Sure.
So we kind of put it all together and made the cake and it looked really weird. And we cut into it. We were all excited. And my mom took a bite and she was like, spit it out. Like, nope, that's not it. What did you do? How did you mess this cake up? And then that's when we learned from mom that, you know, there's a difference between Crisco oil and Crisco shortening. So I try not to cook a whole lot. Like, that's for sure.
That's funny.
And I make a mean homemade pizza, but other than that, there's not a lot.
That's great. Well, this, I mean, what's funny is I've definitely had a few people over the years who, like, I kind of, once you started into like the oil thing, I was like, I know where this is going. As a parent, you're not alone in getting surprised by that situation.
No. That's great.
That's funny. Well, when you make pizza, can you get it into like a circle, the dough? Do you make it from like,
yeah,
nice?
Yeah, we've made it from scratch a couple times, but most of the time it's like the Chef Boyardee mix, sure, you know, or something like that. My wife can't stand it. She hates it, you know, like when we do it, because you know, there's flour everywhere and there's, why don't we just order pizza? You know, that type of thing. But pizza is like a guilty pleasure of mine. I love it. I love trying different pizza places and, you know, stuff like that. But when we can make it, and I tell you what I did, Pete, last year I was on this TikTok shop thing,
sure,
and I bought one of those Paisanos. I don't know if you've seen them, but they're like a little pizza oven. It looks like a spaceship and you open it up.
Oh no, I don't know this.
Stone on the bottom.
Ooh, nice.
And then it's got the heat element on the top. So you actually have individual control. Now I'm nerding out about
this. That's awesome. Do it.
Like, but you can actually turn the knob for the bottom part on up to like 800 degrees, and you can do the same thing with the top. So you can, like, if you like a burnt crust, you could turn, you know, that part of it up and the other one down. But it literally makes, like, you can even put a frozen pizza in there. It'll make amazing pizza in like 7 minutes, 8 minutes. Awesome. And it tastes like you just got it from the pizza place, but it's like $90. Okay. So I was like, all right, I'm going to try it. But yeah, that makes it a little easier now when you have an actual pizza oven.
That's awesome. That's great. I love that. What is a great movie and what is a terrible movie?
Man, the terrible movies, that's a funny question, because the terrible ones, I just never remember what they were. You know, like, we watch so many terrible movies on like Netflix or Prime or whatever, and we're like, what? People said this was good. Like, you know, whatever. Yeah. But I think probably a lot of people will say, you know, share my sentiment that I love the movie. The prison movie.
Oh, Shawshank.
Shawshank Redemption. Like, you got to watch it every time it's on. Like, it's one of my favorite movies. So Shawshank is one of them. I know one that I just hated that my family kind of liked, but was the Quiet movie.
Oh, A Quiet Place.
You couldn't talk.
Yeah.
A Quiet Place. I couldn't stand that movie. I could not stand it for some reason. And I know I'm alone. It's the same thing with Pete. I don't know if you guys are watching Severance.
My wife is watching it. I haven't watched it.
I guess I'm not smart enough to watch Severance, but like, everybody is raving about this series. And I'm trying to follow it. I'm trying to pay attention to it, but like, I don't know whether it's my ADD or what, but like, I just can't like stay engaged in it, you know? So some people will tell me they love it and I'm like, I don't like Severance, you know? So I guess it depends on, you know, anything else, you know, what you like and what you don't like. What about you? What's your favorite movie?
My go-to answer has been Say Anything from the late 80s. Early 90s.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The iconic, you know, boombox on the shoulder. Love it.
Yeah, there's definitely some things about it that are don't age well. That scene is kind of weird now, because you're like, it's kind of stalking, but I rewatched it recently, and the first like 45 minutes are perfect. It's like nothing is wrong with almost the first half. The second half gets weird and is not as good. But
first, what's your favorite movie you've seen lately?
I do pay attention to the Oscars a lot. The movie that probably nobody saw that was up for Best Picture, which is I'm Still Here, which was about,
I haven't seen that.
Yeah. And it was, I don't know. It's probably on like Apple TV or Prime now. It's like one of those where it's about something from the 70s, but it's incredibly timely now.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's called I'm Still Here.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So
yeah,
probably less I say about it, the better, but it's, I would, that was very, very good.
All right, there you go. So everybody that, you know, the five people that are listening,
yeah, they like
to listen to Mark Reynolds, they'll watch that movie.
Yeah. All right, what's a favorite book?
My favorite book is, I would say probably Lead for God's Sake.
Oh, I don't know this one.
Yeah, it's absolutely wonderful. It sounds like it has like a religious undertone. It's really not. It has nothing to do with it. You know, basically the whole premise is it's a like a high school basketball coach that is also a teacher at the high school, and he teaches he coaches the basketball team, and they've won state championships. Well, he's finally got this team that is going to win the state championship. Everybody's coming back. They're all five-star athletes, all this other stuff. And they can't seem to win. Like, they just keep losing games. And he basically befriends the custodian at the high school. And they start having these conversations. And then he starts going down there at lunch and talking to the custodian. And the custodian can read that, like, he's a little down on himself. And like, hey, so how's the team doing? And he's like, I don't know what's going on. And I keep telling, you know, my leaders, like, you got to lead for God's sake. Come on. Like, and so from the book comes this amazing lesson. The custodian is talking to the coach, and basically there's a blackboard behind him, and he draws a stick figure on the blackboard. And in one hand, the stick figure is holding a bag of money. And in the other hand, the stick figure is holding a hatchet. And he explains to the coach, he said, you know, I think you have a leadership problem, in my opinion. And he said, this is a way that people lead. And he draws the stick figure up and he says, you know, if you look at the bag of money, you can lead a team, a group, a band, a percussion ensemble, whatever. You can lead them by holding that bag of money in front of them and saying, look, if you do X, Y, and Z, like, you get this, you know, you'll get a trophy or you get money or whatever.
Yeah.
Or you can lead by a hatchet, which is like, you do this or else, like, by God, you better do this or I'm coming after you, you know, that type of thing. And so the whole book kind of explains how, you know, both of those ways work for sure, but only for a short period of time. So then he goes on in detail and explains that, like, you know, obviously, the you know, those don't work long term. So he talks to him about teaching with love. And like, if the kids know that you love them and the kids know that you care about them, quit asking them to do this, quit telling them they're, if they do X, Y, and Z, they're going to win another state title. Just focus on the kids and focus on the players and love them. And then of course, you know, everything turns around and they start winning and all that other stuff. But there are so many amazing lessons in that book. I can't even remember who wrote it, but it's called Lead for God's Sake, but it's
okay.
It's a 10.
Awesome. What's something on the more obscure level, like, let's say it's something like pop culture-y or something like that, that if you were to meet somebody and they say, I like blank, whatever that is, that you would immediately go, we're good?
I would probably say, obviously, percussion in all of our worlds. Yeah. Like, if we start talking percussion, we can all probably geek out. But I'd say obscure out of percussion, I would say bourbon. Like, I love... Oh.
Nice.
I'm really into the bourbon world. I probably have about 120 bottles right now.
Wow. You know, nice.
I love bourbon. A really, really good friend of mine and a Sabian artist named Cameron Leach.
Yes.
If you haven't seen his bourbon channel, Drums and Drams, yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Cameron lives like 20 minutes from me.
Yeah.
So when COVID happened, that's when I started, and he started getting into bourbon as well.
Yeah.
And we started trying stuff and doing this. And then I was actually, I think I did a podcast with him like over COVID. I went to his house and we just tried a bunch of bourbons and
nice.
Did a podcast or whatever. But now he has just gone above and beyond. Like, his palate is amazing. Yeah. And he's great. But yeah, I would say the bourbon thing, like, I'm really a big fan of just learning about bourbons, how it's made, what it does. You know, like, what this you know, alcohol content can do to ethanol value. Like the whole thing is just really interesting to me, but I also like drinking it. So
yeah. talk. All right.
Exactly.
Open it up.
Well, so much so, Pete, that we had to buy a new refrigerator.
Oh yeah.
2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I told my youngest son, who's 21, Evan, went with me to look at them.
Yeah.
And he was looking at all these crazy ones that have a TV screen on it. And I'm like, Evan, we're not spending that money. Here's our budget. This is what we're spending. And we saw this one and we both agreed like, yeah, this is a good one. And then the one right next to it was only $100 more, but it also makes craft ice, like the ball ice.
Oh, wow.
For like your bourbon, it spits it out at the bottom in the freezer. And I was like, oh, we got to get this. And my son was like, no, you said our budget was this, and that's an extra $100. And I said, I'm going to pay the extra $100. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
There you it know, is. Mom won't be mad at us, you know?
Yeah.
So the new, like it hasn't helped me cut out, you know, bourbon tasting every night. But it is pretty easy to go and open up that bottom drawer and just pick out an ice ball. Cause I have all these molds, that I used to use. Now it just spits them out for me. So
nice. That is hilarious.
Do you like bourbon? I saw your face kind of light up a little bit.
I'm it's okay. It's not my favorite, but I've had Cameron on and his background was the bourbon.
Oh, it's crazy. Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So the joke I made after it was, guess which one of us has a bourbon show, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. No, that's really funny. All right. Where he is. Where is somewhere that you have not traveled to that you still want to get to?
My wife and I really would love to go over to Europe. Like I've been over to Belgium. When I was at Dynasty, we used to take like an indoor group over there every year.
Okay.
Like Rhythm X went 1 year, Matrix went 1 year, Tyler Junior College went 1 year, but I've been over there, but I haven't been to like, you know, Paris and, you know, all that stuff. So my wife and I have been talking about next March is our 30th anniversary. So we've been talking about like, well, let's maybe go over to Europe, you know, and tour. We haven't done all those things, you know. We've spent so much time of our life like trying to take a vacation that our boys would like, you know, going to Disney or Florida or Hilton Head or someplace like that. So I'm really looking forward to hopefully one day, knock on wood, getting over to Europe.
Very cool. That's great. Now, because you've been in the industry for as long as you have, and have probably had to write, you know, 70 billion emails probably at this point, I would assume.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite sign off? Like particularly a sign off for an email where you're like, you know, this needs to be done, or I don't want to have this conversation anymore, something like that. That's very professional, but you know, it's kind of also getting a point across.
I don't have to use it a lot, honestly, but like there have been some times in the past where I've had to say, God, how did I word that? It was respectfully yours or yours truly or something like that. And there were a couple occasions at a former job that I was at that I would have to say, I look forward to hearing your response in the next 24 hours.
I see. Yeah.
That was kind of the passive aggressive, like,
yeah.
You know, I'm going to give you 24 hours, but I'm really looking forward to hearing your response in the next 24.
Yeah. Preferably 24 minutes, if I'm being honest.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly.
That's good.
Well, in the world we live in now with Teams.
Yeah. Oh,
like,
sure.
That's, you know, if you send an email, you could just like look and go, oh, they're on their phone. They're active. I'm going to call them, you know? So like, it's so easy now to just text somebody. But back in the day before it was that, then yeah, sometimes you'd have to be a little forceful with that email.
Yeah, I hear that. All right, last couple. Strangest, funniest, or most bizarre performance moment that involves you?
All right, this would go back to my days when I was in college at Ohio State.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the wind ensemble. It was also the semester that I was doing my senior recital. So I was performing, you know, I was preparing like an hour's worth of music. But in the wind ensemble, we did, I think it was in 93, maybe 94. We were asked to do a recording. And I think it was Deos. Am I pronouncing that right? D-E-J-O-S was the classical company that put it together, but we were doing a recording of all Alan Hovhaness music.
Oh, nice.
And Christian Lindbergh came in to play trombone. And what they did was they brought in a conductor, and his name was Keith Bryan. Okay. And if you don't know the conductor, Keith Bryan, he's phenomenal. He's awesome, but he's more well known as the guy who dressed up as John Philip Sousa and would do all the concerts and, you know, stuff like that. So that's what I thought was weird. Like when they said, oh, Keith Bryan's coming, and I'm like, the guy that dresses up like Sousa, like, you know, whatever. But then he came in and obviously he was amazing. We talked earlier about my teachers at Ohio State University. This was the first year that Fernando Meza came in.
Ah, yeah.
And I think I described earlier, like, that he was kicking all of our butts and, you know, it was amazing. It was great. Well, there was, one of the, I can't even remember now what it was, but it was one of the movements from one of the Hovhaness, pieces that we were doing had like this marimba soli in it. Right. Mm-hmm. So it was basically like, just like a long tone from the woodwinds, and the marimba part, it wasn't that hard. Cause I remember looking at it and going, oh, this doesn't even compare to the stuff I'm playing Gordon Stout. I'm doing all this other stuff. And it wasn't even that fast. It was like 106 beats a minute, maybe 110, whatever. So I knew the recording was coming up the next weekend, but I was like, I can probably sight read that. No big deal. So I was just focused on my recital. So, and I think at that time, I might've been the principal, in the wind ensemble at that time. So Fernando kept asking me in lessons. He's like, are you good with all the Hovhaness stuff? And I'm like, yep, I'm good. And he's like, what about that marimba solo? And I was like, oh yeah, it's fine. You know, I got it. And so fast forward, now we're at the recording session, and the recording studio was kind of off site from where we were recording on stage. So there was literally a red phone that was sitting on the podium. So we're sitting there going through stuff. And every time, like, they would hear something weird, the red phone would ring. Keith would pick it up and go, yeah. Okay. He goes, hey, let's do that one more time. French horns, let's tune again. You know, let's make sure that we got that set, you know, whatever. So we're going right along. We're supposed to go until like 10 o'clock that night. And it's like 9:30. We get to this part, and, you know, I run over from the suspended cymbal and I grab the marimba mallets, and, you know, I look up and I'm ready to go. And there's the part, and I'm like, D-da-ba-ba, and I might've got like four notes in. The phone rings. He goes, yeah, I know. He hangs up and he goes, that's a D sharp, not a D natural. And I was like, Oh, got it. Yeah, I'm good. So now I'm starting to panic. I'm sweating. I'm like, oh crap. Like I really should have practiced this more. So I start going through it again. I get a little further, phone rings, picks it up. Yeah, I know. He's like, that's F natural now. Like, and I was like, oh no. Like, so I'm really showing my stupidity. I'm like, I can't believe I'm telling everybody this. It's pretty embarrassing. So I'm just like, this is not good. Like, okay, let's go. Now, like, Pete, we're like probably 20 minutes into this. That probably is only like 26 bars, 27 bars. And we're already 20 minutes into this. And now I've got like saxophone players like looking back at me like, come on, bro. Like, let's go. It's 10:15. Like, we're supposed to be out of here. And I just can't play anything right now because now I'm inside my head. I can't play anything. I'm embarrassed and, you know, whatever. So finally he stops and I get through and I'm hitting the notes, and he stops and he says, have you heard this recording? And I was like, yeah. And I hadn't heard the recording. And I was like, yeah, I think I've heard this a couple of times. He's like, well, you obviously haven't listened to the recording of this because this isn't even close. And he looks at the director of bands at that time, was a guy named Rick Blatty. And Rick was there for like 30 years. And he looked over at Rick in the back corner of the stage and he pointed at me and he goes, is this the best we got? Really?
Ooh. Ooh.
And that hurts. In front of the entire wind ensemble. Oh. And I tell you what, it was the best learning moment because I never blew anything off ever again. Like, I don't care what it was. Like, I always took the time to make sure I listened to recordings or whatever. So he said, you'll meet me back in here tomorrow morning at 7:30. And we're going to record this without the band and we'll just have them layer it over top or whatever. And I was like, oh my gosh. So I was nervous. Luckily, like, I think one of the girls that was the grad student that was like teaching woodwind methods, I just had woodwind methods. she worked at the library and got me into the school library. Mm. And I found the recording. I listened to it at like midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, like 30 times. Then I went to, I mean, this is before cell phones and iPads and all that other stuff. Yeah. So then I went to the practice room and I worked on it the whole time. And it, before I knew it, it was 6:00, 6:30 in the morning. And I got coffee, showed back up at 7:30, and it was just me, the director of bands, and Keith Bryan. And he said, "Are you ready?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he walked over to the podium. I'm walking to the marimba and Rick Blatty looks at me and he goes, Are you wearing the same thing you had on yesterday?" And I said, "Yes, sir. I have not been to bed. I've been in a practice room. I've been to the music library. I'm good." And it took like maybe a minute and a half, laid it down. Everything was good. And then he was like, "Okay, let's try to inflect this a little bit." And I'm like, "Okay, no problem." Like literally it was like a 2 minute, you know, scenario. That was maybe a long story, but it was really, I've told a lot of my students about that. Like, don't take this for granted. Like, this happened to me. So now every time I see, you know, Keith Bryan or someplace, I've always wanted to walk up to him and go, "Do you remember me? I was that really horrible percussionist." But it sounds great on the recording. So
yeah, that's awesome. So Mark, one piece of art, it could be movies, music, books, podcasts, YouTube clips, theater, visual art, poetry, anything that has impacted you the most recently.
Probably, well, not probably, without a doubt. My son, my oldest son, is an artist. And he graduated from Ohio State 2 years ago with an art degree and was in the marching band at Ohio State, played bass drum for us for 5 years. And the original painting was done in the our band facility at Ohio State is in the stadium, right? In Ohio Stadium, which is awesome. It's great on game days. You can feel the energy. It's awesome. But when you walk into the stadium, it's 103 years old now, I think. But when you walk in the stadium, before you get to the doors to walk up to the band facility, there's a huge wall that always had a mural on it that was painted, I think, in the 80s. It was a good painting. Everything was, it was great. But like, we have a diversity committee, at Ohio State for the marching band. And, you know, we talk to them about like, you know, what else can we be doing and, you know, whatever. And we started getting, I'm going to mess up the date, but I think it was like 73, 74, somewhere around there was the first time that they allowed women to be in the marching band at Ohio State. When we started talking to this diversity committee, like 4 or 5 years ago of students, they were very honest. And they said, "You know, I have a real issue that when you walk into our band facility that we're very proud of, that huge 20-foot wall mural is great, but it only depicts white males.
Yeah.
Is there anything we can do to put some females on there, or men and women of color or anything like that?" And we were like, "We never even yes. Like, let's start an initiative to start trying to get this, you know, get this redone." So we put a bunch of things together. We got a bunch of artists from all around that, you know, put in, you know, some things for it. Long story short, my son like won the job, you know, which I didn't even know that he was even putting in for. So I got to watch him for 18 months work on hand painting this incredible mural that's on the wall. And then up two flights of stairs. He also did stuff up two flights of stairs that depict men and women of color, different ethnicities. And we're very proud of it, at the university, but more proud that like every time I walk in there, it's like a piece of art that my son, you know, did, which is pretty, pretty awesome. So, you know, I've seen a lot of different art in my day, but like to see him over 18 months, like on scaffolding, like hand painting, you know, stuff that is so dear to my heart in terms of the marching band. It's something I'll never forget for sure.
What a blast it was to talk to Mark. It was really exciting on my end to get to chat with someone who so clearly loves the company and the products that he works for and has so much enthusiasm for the percussion field in general. And not only that, he also loves getting to work with the people he gets to work with and represent. And fortunately for me, and those of you who listen to the show, I've had a chance to interview a lot of them here, but also look forward to hopefully getting the chance to interview more of them in the future. Thank you so much, Mark, and best of luck going forward. This week's rave is the classic 1974 film The Conversation, starring the recently departed Gene Hackman, along with John Cazale, Alan Garfield, Terry Garr, and Harrison Ford, among others, and written and directed by Francis Ford Coppola, available to stream on Amazon Prime. It is always great to revisit great works of art at a later point in one's life. I think I saw this when I was a grad student, but I'll be honest, I didn't really remember it all that well, which meant it was the perfect time to watch again, and I'm glad I did. The movie was written and directed by Francis Ford Coppola, who also produced it, and this was at a time that he was on an incredible run as a filmmaker. This movie comes out in between the releases of the first two Godfather films, which are frequently ranked as some of the best films of all time, and would soon be followed later in the decade by Apocalypse Now, one of the greatest war movies of all time. This film is frequently the one that either gets buried or downplayed, almost intentionally, even though Coppola sees it as one of his most personal films. The plot follows a gentleman named Harry Call, who's played by Hackman, a surveillance expert who is hired by a mysterious company to follow a young couple by audio recording them at all hours through a variety of, at the time, incredibly up-to-date means. The film employs all sorts of incredible audio Foley work and sound editing to create some of the sounds throughout, as well as not employing traditional movie music, which leads to a lot of background noise and silence. The audio production brings an enormous amount of unease and stress that permeates throughout the film, and the tension is felt by all those who are in the movie. There's a lot to like about the film, including, honestly, just the timing. While this movie had been in development for a while, it appears in theaters right in the midst of President Richard Nixon's downfall and eventual resignation of the office of the President of the United States that same year. It seemed to be prescient in its observations of the surveillance state. Also, there are many great performances involved, including Alan Garfield as Hackman's main competitor, and Harrison Ford as the company's main assistant. But honestly, this is a movie all about Hackman. Though Gene Hackman would win Oscars for two different movies, The French Connection and Unforgiven, this may have been actually his best and most difficult performance. In the conversation, it becomes clear that Hackman may be a surveillance expert, but he's also reckless and not particularly good at his job or keeping it a secret. And even though he gets hired to do dangerous work, he starts to get paranoid about the whole process of what he's doing that become clear as the movie progresses. Again, perfectly in line with what was going on politically at the time. Additionally, we purposefully seem to also know next to nothing about Hackman's character. He has a couple of love interests. They don't really know him at all. His coworkers don't know him at all. And he passes the time alone playing tenor saxophone along with live jazz recordings. And honestly, again, this seems very relevant, not just to the time it came out, but also currently, particularly with so many folks feeling isolated as it is. There's a lot more to say about this movie, but it's one that I've given you a little bit of a heads up of what's going on, and you should check it out yourself. I know it's an older movie, but it moves at an effective pace and it is gripping to watch. Check out The Conversation. I think you'll enjoy. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. You can find every episode and the show notes at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. The show is also on SoundCloud and Spotify and many other podcast locations. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can find me there on Instagram and X at Pete Zambito or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com. And I will catch you next time.